These lectures are titled, From Jesus to Constantine, A History of Early Christianity, Part 2. Lecture 13, Christian Reactions to Persecution.
In the previous lecture, we saw some of the reasons for the violent opposition to Christians throughout the Roman Empire. Christians were seen as a threat to society because they refused to worship the state gods. Disasters that struck could be seen by pagans then as divine retribution for cities that harbored such atheists. Christians were called atheists because they didn't worship the gods of the state. So that today we would think of an atheist as somebody who didn't believe in God. In the ancient world, an atheist was somebody who didn't sacrifice to the gods. Christians were sometimes also thought to be morally reprehensible, in that they were thought to perform acts of incest, infanticide, and cannibalism during their worship services on a weekly basis. Remember, they would meet early before the sun came up. They would call one another brother and sister. They would greet one another with a kiss. And so outsiders who didn't understand the ritual would assume that there were some acts of incest going on. Moreover, they were known to eat the flesh and drink the blood of the Son of God. And so people assumed that they were performing acts of infanticide and cannibalism. Christians were thought then to be socially dangerous. Christians, of course, denied that they were dangerous. And many of them refused to recant their beliefs, even in the face of violent opposition and concerted official efforts. In this lecture, we will shift from considering the persecution from the pagan perspective, that is, we won't be now asking, why did pagans act this way, to look at the Christian perspective. How did Christians react to their opposition by pagans? How did they react to persecutions and threats? First, as you might expect, we do have record of some Christians recanting of their faith in Christ in the face of violent opposition. This can be seen in some of the literature that we've looked at already. In a previous lecture, we considered the case of the Christians of Vienne and Lyon in a letter written by the survivors of a persecution that happened around the year 177. Christians in Vienne and Lyon were persecuted first by the mobs and then by officials and underwent horrible torments and tortures, some of them actually martyred. But we find in this letter that was written by the survivors, which is recorded for us by the church historian Eusebius, that not everybody who was a Christian decided to go through with the persecution. Some, in fact, apparently recanted of their belief so as to avoid persecution. And so we read. The authors tell us. The rest of the people fell into two groups. The rest of the Christians fell into two groups. It was clear, says the author, that some were ready to be the first Gallic martyrs. In other words, the first martyrs in Gaul, ancient France. These people, these Christians, made a full confession of their testimony with the greatest eagerness. But, the author says, it was equally clear that others were not ready, that they had not been trained and were still flabby. This is a reference to the Christians who are willing to be persecuted are great warriors and they're in good shape and trained. But these others who weren't willing to be martyred are not trained and still flabby, in no fit condition to face the strain of a struggle to the death. Of these, some 10 proved stillborn, causing us great distress and inexpressible grief and damping the enthusiasm of those who were not yet arrested. And so this author notes that there were 10 individuals who had been Christian, or at least claimed to be Christian, when the heat was turned up. However, they recanted of their faith, and so they were not born again. They were stillborn. So that these were people then who recanted of their faith in the face of violent opposition. The same theme can be found in another book that we've looked at, The Martyrdom of Polycarp. One passage we did not consider in The Martyrdom of Polycarp concerns a person who recanted of his faith when being faced with persecution. This is in chapter 4 of The Martyrdom of Polycarp. Remember, Polycarp was the bishop of Smyrna who was arrested and put on trial in the arena, who refused to recant of his faith and then was burned at the stake. There was a miracle surrounding his death, but eventually he did die by the executioner's sword. Early on in the account, we find a reference to another person who was arrested as well, who had a completely different fate. This is a person named Quintus. And we're told that this Quintus was from the region of Phrygia, who, when he saw the wild beasts being leased upon him, turned coward. This was the man, says the author of this letter, this was the man who had forced himself and some others to come forward voluntarily. In other words, this is somebody who turned himself in as a Christian so that he could face martyrdom. But when the beast came out, he chickened out and said, no, I recant. The proconsul, after many appeals, finally persuaded Quintus to swear the oath to the emperor and to offer the sacrifice. And then the author adds a little note. For this reason, therefore, brothers, we do not praise those who hand themselves over, since the gospel does not so teach. This author doesn't think that Christians should voluntarily undergo martyrdom, that if they're sought out and arrested because they're Christian, they should, of course, go through with it, but they shouldn't put themselves forward, because here's an instance of somebody who put himself forward and yet then afterwards recanted. Well, they don't want that. We know of some Christian groups that actively opposed martyrdom. Christians who advocated recanting or pretending to recant so as to avoid being tortured and killed for the faith. In particular, we know of one group of Christians that maintained that it was better to recant and not be killed precisely on theological grounds. These were people who insisted that since Christ died for others, then others should not die. If Christ paid the price for sins, then others don't have to pay the price. And therefore, Christ, God, doesn't want people to be martyred. God, Christ, want people to live. And so it's better to do whatever the authorities say to escape martyrdom, and just you just have to do it in bad faith. You just cross your fingers behind your back when you make the sacrifice or swear the oath, that in fact is what God wanted. And so there were groups of people who did precisely that, maintaining that it was God's will to do in bad faith whatever the authorities insisted on, and so live. It's difficult to know how many Christians recanted or pretended to recant in the face of physical torment. One of the reasons it's difficult to know is because most of our surviving accounts are written by Christians who celebrate martyrdom, who want to show the supernatural strength given the martyrs in the face of their death, as seen in the lengthy accounts of the martyrs of Vienne and Lyon and in the martyrdom of Polycarp. So since the people who are actually doing the writing that has survived are in support of martyrdom, you don't find too many instances of people recanting. So historically, it's hard to know how many recanted. These authors of the surviving works want to celebrate martyrdom as a Christian virtue, to show that these Christians, in fact, were strong and supported by God in the face of death. A similar message of a Christian who is stalwart in the face of death can be seen in the powerful account of the martyrdom of a woman named Perpetua. This account, the martyrdom of Perpetua, is a very famous document from the early 3rd century. Perpetua was a 22-year-old matron, a mother, who was a recent convert to Christianity, who lived in North Africa, and whose martyrdom took place in the year 203 A.D. The story of her martyrdom is remarkable in several respects, most particularly because a good deal of the account that we have of her arrest and imprisonment is written in her own hand. She actually kept a diary, and we have the diary. It's quite unusual from the ancient world to have a first-hand account of this sort, and it's especially unusual to have it from a woman. So this is Perpetua is a highly educated woman who's able to compose in Latin, and she's kept this diary. Somebody later discovered the diary. A Christian, apparently it was bequeathed to the Christians who survived this particular martyrdom in the early 3rd century North Africa. Somebody took the diary that Perpetua had prepared and added a short preface to it, and then added an ending to it, which actually describes her martyrdom. The diary records the events transpiring while she's in prison awaiting her martyrdom. So it's quite a remarkable and unique piece of literature that we have, the martyrdom of Perpetua. Included in this diary is a record of what happened to her and her fellow Christian martyrs while they're awaiting their execution. It records accounts of her trials, her reactions, her fears, and it includes a series of visions that she had while she was awaiting her death, where she describes dreams that she's had, which are symbolic of what she expects to have happened to her. One of the most gripping elements of the story is the reaction that Perpetua herself records towards her poor father. Poor, not economically poor, but poor fellow that his daughter is facing death and is refusing to recant in the face of her approaching execution. Her father is a pagan who doesn't understand why she's insisting on dying for the faith. He tries in vain to get her to see reason for his sake and for the sake of her own child. She has a young infant that is still she's still nursing, and he's trying to get her to recant because of this baby that's hers, and if she dies, what will happen to the child? And of course, he's trying to get her to recant for her own sake. Let me read several passages from this diary of Perpetua about her reaction towards her father. "While we were still under arrest," she says in her diary, "my father, out of love for me, was trying to persuade me and to shake my resolution. 'Father,' said I, 'do you see this vase here, for example, or water pot or whatever?' 'Yes, I do,' he said. And I told him, 'could it be called by any other name than what it is?' He said, 'No.' 'Well, so too I cannot be called anything other than what I am, a Christian.' At this, my father was so angered by the word Christian that he moved towards me as though he would pluck my eyes out. But he left it at that and departed, vanquished, along with his diabolical arguments." And so she considers his arguments to be diabolical. So she's rejecting her father, who, after all, is just after her in concern for her own well-being. Well, a little later we have another account. "My father arrived in the city again, worn with worry, and he came to see me with the idea of persuading me. 'Daughter,' he said, 'have pity on my gray head. Have pity on me, your father, if I deserve to be called your father. If I have favored you above all your brothers, if I have raised you to reach the prime of your life, do not abandon me to the reproach of others. Think of your brothers, think of your mother and your aunt, think of your child, who will not be able to live once you are gone. Give up your pride, you will destroy all of us.'" Well, again, it's to no avail. She doesn't yield. She goes on trial before the proconsul. When her turn, so they're trying one by one, these Christians, when her turn came, "my father appeared with my son, dragging me from the step and say, 'perform the sacrifice, have pity on your child.' But Hilarionus, the governor, who had received his judicial powers, said to me, 'have pity on your father's gray head, have pity on your infant child.'" So again, you have a case where the governor is trying to get these people to recant. He doesn't want to kill these people. He wants them just simply to recant so that they don't have to go through with this. "Offer the sacrifice for the welfare of the emperors." "I will not," I retorted. "Are you a Christian?" said Hilarionus. And I said, "Yes, I am." When my father persisted in trying to dissuade me, Hilarionus ordered him to be thrown to the ground and beaten with a rod. I felt sorry for my father, just as if I myself had been beaten. I felt sorry for his pathetic old age. But she didn't feel sorry enough to recant. She spurns her father's pleas. She ends up relinquishing her child to others, and she goes to her death eagerly. I mentioned that she had several visions. I want to talk about one of these visions because it's quite interesting. She has several dreams that she records while she's there in the prison, one of which is described in what is now chapter 10. It's a vision that she has of her approaching death. It's the day before they are to fight the wild beasts. And she has this dream in which one of the deacons of her church comes and opens the door and leads her into the arena. They come into the amphitheater, this deacon leads her to the center of the arena. And he told her, then he told me, "Do not be afraid, I'm here struggling with you." Then he left. Okay, so this is all in a dream that she's having the day before the event itself. "Then there came out an Egyptian against me, of vicious appearance, together with his seconds to fight with me." So it's going to be a gladiatorial combat. She, this 22-year-old woman, is going to fight this vicious Egyptian. "My clothes were stripped off, and suddenly I was a man." She's become a man in this vision. "My seconds began to rub me down with oil, as they are wont to do before a contest, and I saw that the Egyptian on the other side rolling in the dust." I guess these are two different ways to make your body slippery for your opponent. "Next there came forth a man of marvelous stature," and there's this huge giant who comes into the arena with a wand and a green branch, and this apparently is a vision of Christ coming to the arena, and he says that if this Egyptian defeats her, he will slay her with the sword, but if she defeats him, she will receive the branch, and then he withdrew. "We drew close to one another and began to let our fists fly." So she's fighting this Egyptian. "My opponent tried to get hold of my feet, but I kept striking him in the face with the heels of my feet. Then I was raised up into the air, and I began to pummel him without, as it were, touching the ground." I can't read this anymore without thinking of The Matrix. This is exactly those scenes in The Matrix. That's exactly what's going on here in this dream. "Then when I noticed there was a lull, I put my two hands together, linking the fingers of one hand with those of the other, and I got a hold of his head. He fell flat on his face, and I stepped on his head." She ends up defeating him. And then Christ comes back and gives her the branch of peace. "Then I awoke. I realized that it was not with wild animals that I would fight, but with the devil. And I knew that I would win the victory." Egypt is always portrayed in biblical narrative, of course, as the enemy of the people of God. And so this is an Egyptian, the enemy, who in fact is the devil. And she sees that she's going to overcome this Egyptian. She becomes a man. That's a theme in many of these early martyrdoms, that to be a real man means to be courageous. The word in Greek for courageous, in fact, is the word being a man. And so she takes on male characteristics so that she can fight this Egyptian and then progress to victory and then on to God. The account of Perpetua's death in the arena is then narrated by the editor who took her diary and incorporated the diary into the longer martyrology, which has been popular down through the ages and until today. You can still obviously buy this and read it. It's quite interesting. The death itself is narrated by the editor. What happens is they take her and a female slave who's a Christian, a woman named Felicitas, who has just given birth, so that she's still lactating. They strip them naked and put them in nets, and they take them into the arena. But the people see that here's this young matron and this slave woman whose breasts are still lactating, and the crowds get upset about this. They want them to be dressed. Apparently, the crowds don't mind if they're fully dressed and get mauled by these beasts. They just don't want to see them naked being mauled by the beasts. And so they dress them, and they let loose a wild heifer onto them, thinking that it'd be interesting to have a female beast destroy these female humans. The heifer attacks them and knocks them over and mauls them, but doesn't kill them. The crowds think that's enough for one day, and so they send them back to jail to bring them out the next day. The next day, then they send out gladiators to kill them, and one by one the gladiators strike them with the sword and kill them. But when the gladiator comes up to Perpetua, he apparently tries to stab her, but the sword hits a bone and stops and doesn't get to her heart. And so Perpetua herself, we're told, takes the gladiator's hand with it's not quite clear if it's a short sword or a dagger, and forces the hand up to her own throat and kills herself by thrusting it through her throat, showing that she's in control of her own death even to the very end. Well, it's a disturbing account This is a young woman who had everything ahead of her, educated, a young mother. Why were Christians like this so willing to die? We've seen other incidences of Blandina, the woman Blandina in the letter of Leon of Vienne. Polycarp, the aged bishop in Smyrna, now Perpetua in North Africa. They're so firm in refusing to recant, so stalwart in the face of death, so eager to die. What is it that's driving these people to want to escape this world? We can never know, of course, their personal reasons. Even though we have Perpetua's diary, we don't really know what's going on inside their minds. But we do have some indications from the writings about them by the Christians who were left behind concerning why Christians might have preferred public torture and humiliation and death to a long life, why they would prefer one to the other. First thing is something we've noticed already. It appears that many Christians were convinced that as bad as the torments of the present were, they were not nearly so bad as the torments awaiting those who rejected Christ in the world to come. This is explicitly stated in the martyrdom of Polycarp and in the letter of the churches of Lyon and Vienne, namely that as bad as the torment is now that you experience, it's nothing compared to the tortures that would await if, in fact, you weren't on the side of God. And so, for example, in the martyrdom of Polycarp, we find this statement that the martyrs, not Polycarp himself, but these other martyrs, turned their thoughts to the grace of Christ so that they despised the tortures of this world, purchasing at the cost of 1 hour an exemption from eternal punishment. And the fire of their inhuman tortures felt cold to them, for they set before their eyes the escape from that eternal fire which is never extinguished. This is rooted in a kind of theodicy. Theodicy is an important word for many of these texts. The word theodicy refers to the righteousness of God. How is God righteous when so much suffering is in this world? Early Christians maintained that this world was controlled by forces of evil. Some Christians maintained that God had relinquished control of this world to these evil forces. But they insisted that ultimately God was going to triumph. If not in this life, then in the afterlife. God's going to have the final say. Those who are torturing us now, they're going to pay their full reward later. God is going to have the last say. And so it is better to side with God and pay the ultimate price now, because then you will have an eternal reward. Refusing to pay the price now means you'll pay the price later. This message then became one of the central features of Christian preaching. It relates, as you can notice, to the exclusivistic claims of these Christians. These Christians were saying not only that they were right in what they believed, they were saying that those who chose not to agree with them would be punished with horrific torments eternally. There's one set of truths. These truths have to be adhered to. If you don't adhere to these truths, then you will pay the price forever. So one reason the Christians may have been willing to undergo this is because of their belief in the afterlife. Second, some Christians saw that a violent death at the hands of the authorities was a way to imitate Christ in this world, who had himself died a public, humiliating, painful death. And so some Christians insisted that the way to be a real imitator of Christ, their Savior, was to suffer similarly. This view can be seen most clearly in the writings of one of the first Christians known to be martyred after the New Testament period, an author whose name is Ignatius of Antioch. Ignatius was the bishop of this major city, Antioch, in the early 2nd century. Around the year 110, so we're talking about 90 years before Perpetua, around the year 110, Ignatius was arrested in Antioch, apparently for Christian activities, and he was sent off to Rome to be thrown to the wild beasts. While en route to Rome to face his own martyrdom, Ignatius wrote a number of letters, and we still have these letters. This is another quite remarkable corpus of writings that we have. Letters written by a Christian who is about to be martyred en route to Rome, where he is to be thrown to the wild beasts. Six of these letters he wrote to various churches that he whose representatives he had met on the way. So we have six letters written to various churches in which he tells the churches how to deal with their particular problems, how to be unified, that they ought to follow their bishops, they ought to be submissive to what their bishop says. He tries to get rid of heresy in these various churches. He's concerned about their welfare. One of the letters, though, is written to not to a church who had sent representatives to meet him on the way. One of the letters is written to the Christians in the city of Rome, where he's going. He writes the Christians in Rome in order to urge them not to interfere with the proceedings against him once he arrived. He doesn't want them to stop his execution, since, in his view, it was by dying a violent death that he would be united with Christ, and so he would, as he says, attain to God. We have these seven letters. These seven letters have survived through the Middle Ages down to today, and they make for very interesting reading, especially this letter to the Romans. Let me read several parts of this letter. This may sound somewhat pathological to you, but one person's pathology is another person's common sense. This is common sense for Ignatius. "Let me be fodder for the wild beast," says Ignatius to the Roman Christians. "That is how I can get to God. I am God's wheat, and I am being ground by the teeth of wild beasts to be made a pure loaf of bread for Christ. I would rather that you fawn on the beasts, so that they may be my tomb and no scrap of my body be left. Thus, when I have fallen asleep, I shall be a burden to no one. Then I shall be a real disciple of Christ. Then the world will see my body no more. What a thrill I shall have from the wild beasts that are ready for me. I hope they will make short work of me. I shall coax them on to eat me up all at once and not hold off, as sometimes happens. Now is the moment I'm beginning to be a disciple," he says. "May nothing seen or unseen begrudge me making my way to Jesus Christ. Come, fire, cross, battling with wild beasts, wrenching of bones, mangling of limbs, crushing of my whole body, cruel tortures of the devil, only let me get to Jesus Christ." And so he goes on, talking about how he wants to imitate the passion of Christ, the death of Christ, so that he will be worthy of meeting Christ in the afterlife. As I pointed out, well, I didn't need to point it out, this longing for violent death may sound pathological to our ears, but for him it was only logical. This world was of no importance to Ignatius. What mattered was the other world, the world of God, which he could attain by imitating the martyrdom of Christ himself. This appears to have been a view of many of the early Christian martyrs. Not only were they thinking that the afterlife would be much better for them if they suffer this torment, if they refuse to suffer, they themselves would go through eternal torment. They're also thinking about imitating Christ's own martyrdom. To sum up, it's difficult to know, actually, how many Christians went to face their death in this way. We don't know what the numbers are because nobody recorded the numbers. The church father Eusebius, who records some of these incidents, will sometimes say that 6 people were killed here or 10 people were killed there. But by and large, we don't know how many people actually died. And I should point out that the people writing the accounts of the martyrdoms are always Christians who survived. So that these persecutions weren't going after every Christian, because a lot of people were left who witnessed the event and wrote about it. So it's difficult to know how many Christians had to face death this way. Some of these people facing their death by martyrdom evidently recanted of their Christian faith, or at least they pretended to recant of their faith when they were put to the test so that they wouldn't have to go through with it. Others, though, submitted themselves to public torment and death, both because in doing so, they understood that they were escaping the real and eternal suffering that would come to non-believers in the afterlife, and because they thought that by dying in this way, they could imitate their Lord and Master Christ. If Christ got flogged and then crucified for the sins of the world, and we want to be his followers, we are going to experience his fate, which means we too will suffer and die at the hands of the enemies. There were yet other Christians who decided to try to defend themselves against the charges leveled against them. The Greek word for defense, as I've pointed out earlier, is apologia, our English word apology. In our next lecture, we'll be examining the writings of the Christian apologists, the defenders of the faith against its culture despisers, those who are trying to make an intellectual defense to show why it was that Christians should not be persecuted and martyred.